Go ahead.
Bo.
All right. That's wrong.
So, okay. So, when one teaches the Dharma, I, like every other Dharma teacher, use basically words with the occasional facial expression and gesture. But basically, it's all happening in words, which is what we call declarative memory or experience. It's stuff that we can state, concepts, ideas, words. And of course, words have a lot of value to them. Words can be stored. We can store ideas. We can email ideas. We can translate ideas. That's good. The Buddha's teachings happened 2,500 years ago. And so I'm glad that they were both storable and translatable from the Pali. Words are very useful in instructing. If somebody, if a child walks around without shoes, you can point out shoes to them, and if they don't know how to tie their shoelaces, you can step them through it. If you don't know how to do something, you can go type it into Google. How do I give a Dharma talk? And then up on YouTube, there I am, giving you a... I wouldn't do that, but somebody would do that. Somebody's probably got a YouTube video how to give a Dharma talk, or how to install a door, or how to nail a nail, or, you know, whatever. There's so it's very useful words for instruction. It can point people in the right direction. So we live very much, those of us who come from a certain background often grow up idealizing ideas. I grew up in a family, my father was an artist, my mom was a writer, my sister is a very highly regarded scholar and professor. And so in my family, like many others, we didn't worship any gods. We were pretty much all of us atheists. There was Buddhist practice in my family, but there was the altar we worshiped at was the big idea. I mean, there was bookshelves all over the place with books stuffed into every available space. This is what the Upper West Side was like in the 1970s. So, 1980s. Ideas everywhere. And for me, when I came to Buddhism as a very young man, I was looking for the big idea that was going to make everything make sense. Because that's how you make sense of life, I thought, through ideas. There's got to be this one big idea somewhere between Sartre and the Buddha and Derrida and Foucault. You smush them all together, and if you get the mixture just right, there's that perfect paragraph that will make sense of it all. And the idea being that you'll never have to suffer again. All the bad shit in life will go away. There won't be any First Noble Truth. There won't be any aging, sickness, death, loss, grief, abandonment, not getting what we want, getting what we don't want. All that will be protected. Just give me that big idea. And of course, it's much more attractive when people worship at the altar of ideas than when they worship at the altar of money or careerism or consumerism or beauty. Those things are really kind of shallow and icky. Look at my beautiful car. That's kind of awful. But it sounds sort of nice to say, I had a great idea today. That's like, ooh, really? Yeah. Somebody comes up to you like, look how beautiful I am today. You're like, well, that's what Facebook is for, right? Look how beautiful I am. Yeah. I mean, people pretend that's what they're not doing. They're like, the best photo ever of them, they put up, and then somebody says, oh, you look beautiful, and they say, oh, it's the same thing. I don't know why you would say that. I only photoshopped it for 12 hours. So it sounds so much better, the worship at the altar of the big idea. And then when we think we've graduated from that, and we worship at the altar of the perfect emotion. I feel love, nothing but love. It's all about love. And love is great, and believe me, it's a very much a step in the right direction. So is compassion. But all of these are just moving us towards a real end. So anyway, back to words, back to ideas. The one things they don't convey are, the few things they don't convey are feelings, inner sensations. We know what Tolstoy wrote, but we don't know how he felt writing it. We don't know what Nabokov felt while writing. We don't know when somebody says, I feel great. We know that that's a good sign, but we don't know exactly how they're feeling great. What is it? They're feeling emotionally better, or is it physically better? Is it a mental energy that they're feeling better? Have they gotten good news? We don't, you know, we can't step into their awareness, their experience of their bodies, their felt sensations, and know what that is. So besides declarative memory and wisdom, there is what's known as procedural, which is not based in ideas or words. It's actually based in felt sensations and movements. If I show you how to, or I step you through the basic idea of riding a bike, that's one thing, but the actual learning of riding a bike or shooting a basketball or learning to play a musical instrument comes from all the thousands of hours you spend alone sucking at it, repeating over and over the muscle movements of strumming a guitar and moving your fingers on the fretboard until the movements become what's known as consolidated. They require less and less conscious overriding. You don't need to think yourself through, and they become more and more automatic. What's happened is the muscle movements have moved from are not being directed by the frontal lobe, they're now being directed by the basal ganglia and the somatosensory lobe, which you knew, so I'll move on. But, so the idea is the more we learn a procedural memory, a felt memory, something that we do by feel, not by conscious, conceptual, word or image-based override, but just by the feel of it, over time, what we're doing is ridding the language, the ideas, the conscious overriding. In fact, there's a great, wonderful passage in Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, where he talks about, he's talking with, I think, a neuroscientist who says, if you really want to fuck up a tennis player who's really good and you're going to play tennis with him, ask the tennis player right before you play, how does he do his backhand, or she do her backhand? You'll totally fuck them up. Because what you're going to do is move the movements from the basal ganglia back to the foreground, and as they have to instruct you, you're going to actually make that movement no longer fluid and automatic. You're going to make it halting, and because conscious override is so less accurate and adept at controlling the body, the movements become jerky when we think things through. It's the same with driving a car. If you Imagine driving a car or talk somebody through it, you'll make them crash instantly. The movements are very fluid and require feel and touch. So, here comes some of the important ideas, which is that healing in life and making sense of life and processing our experience are not declarative. We want them to be declarative, and I'll go into that in a second, but actually they're procedural, they're felt. In life, when we go through abandonment, heartbreak, loss, when somebody mistreats us, when somebody abandons us, we can point to that experience with words. We can describe that experience. And very often, it's tempting to think that we've gotten a handle on some shitty experience because we can say what we think it all meant. Well, I really learned, you know, you can't trust anybody. Whatever, people, you got to stop and smell the roses. But that's just it. When we really learn, it's a procedural felt experience of being with the loss that it manifests itself with hollowness in the chest and with tightness in the stomach. Or when we're angry, the anger is not in the story. That's not the anger. The anger is in the heat in the body, the sense of this movement that's moving up and wants to come out of us. It's a feeling. This leads to a lot of confusion when people hear the Buddha say, put aside thoughts of anger. They, in our culture, because we so reify thoughts and ideas, we say, well, that's stifling emotion. That's just wrong. But it's not. Because the anger and the sadness and the guilt and the fear, these are felt experiences. They reside somatically, physically. They have feeling tones to them. When you get in touch in therapy with feeling that you might not have ever received love from a caretaker, or that you were shunned at a crucial part of your life or not emotionally mirrored, to really experience and process that is not to somehow say, well, I had a good cry. It's literally to feel those, to go back and re-experience that feeling of being abandoned. And instead of being confused by it and pushing it away like we did originally, or running from it, or being overwhelmed by it, now, as adults, we can actually be with the feelings and give them the honor of the attention that they deserve. This is what it means to make sense of a trauma. This is what it means to process an experience. Not to come up with a nice little bow of a thought, because the deep experiences in life, when we really come to grips with them, they're not going to be interesting ideas. When I watched both my parents die, one right after the other, and I was right there seeing it, I wasn't able to convey that experience of knowing, seeing, this is my fate. You know, this is going to happen to me. See it through this contact of feeling. That's not something I can express. When we have a health scare and somebody says, what was it like? And you say, well, you know, I learned you got to stop and smell the roses because life is short. And you sound like a fucking Hallmark card, you know. And people are like, oh, okay, thanks a lot. That's great. You know, but that's the way deep feelings occur. They don't occur in nice ideas. And if we want to live by the flag entirely of this belief that it all occurs in thought, in words, then we're missing the bulk of where the true learning, the true understanding, the true core experiences of life occur. Now, I understand why all of us, including myself, very much I love the idea that that understanding should be in concepts, because this is how we communicate with others. And the idea that it's really a felt experience, that's not really communicable. You can't know what it was like when I was in therapy and experienced this sense, this reconnection with myself as a four-year-old with a drunk father. You don't know what that's like. You can hear me say it. You can understand that maybe something important happened, but you can't feel that feeling of fear that I got back in touch with. So we all would like it if there is some way we can convey it. But language doesn't do that. It doesn't portray feelings. And our memory is so... That's why it's so difficult to, by the way, remember what pain feels like. There's a saying that when women go through childbirth, that right during it, an immediate aftermath, they say, I'll never do that again. But then, a little while later often, they're willing to go through that horror. Because we don't remember pain, because it's not storable declaratively. And because the things that we experience and learn in procedural memory, they have to be experienced over and over and over and over and over again. So the few experiences of sharp pain we don't really store in procedural memory. So unfortunately, it's not very exciting. Doesn't lead to a lot of recognition. It doesn't even, one of the nice things about big ideas is that they give the illusion that we can make sense of it all. I remember every time, my favorite place to be when I was as a kid and as a young man was the philosophy section of St. Mark's bookstore. I mean, they're just like salivating over each book, which looked so important and so filled with the thing that was going to rescue me from my stress and suffering. And each book seemed to hold the promise that if I just understood it, could work my way through and understand all of Jacques Lacan or all of Foucault, I would somehow get it. That would be my ticket. But unfortunately, none of life's discomforts go away. They don't. What happens is, if we focus on developing the procedural ability to sit with discomfort and develop ease and not identify with the past, with this fleeting state, we identify instead with the awareness and develop an ability to be present, even when sadness and loneliness and boredom, even when these things arise. And all of our culture says you shouldn't have to ever experience boredom. That's why we are so bombarded with information. But if we can sit with these experiences and develop ease with them, that's where true wisdom, true experiential wisdom develops. That's where true peace develops. And that's the goal. The goal is being in a mind that's at peace. It's not even so much an emotional goal. It's a goal where we're not adding suffering and misery to our lives by believing there's something wrong when the inevitable stresses and dissatisfactions and frustrations and losses occur. So again, like all of this, what we're after is a balance. We're not, none of this is about getting rid of conceptual thought, God forbid. We need, in fact, conceptual thought in the opening stages of our practice. Even in every meditation, we need it to point us in the right direction of where to focus the mind and to remind us what not to do and to goad us and to reward us for our efforts. It's very useful having the declarative memory, thoughts, ideas to help structure and help keep us in the right direction. But the real work comes when we really are capable of sitting and feeling and being present with what's being felt inside. So I think that's it for tonight's talk. I thank you for listening. Hope there was something worth reflecting on. And now it's your turn to ask any questions that might come to mind. Thanks.